Spirit Blade Underground, episode 371. Warning, access restricted. Please submit to DNA verification. Processing. Verification complete. Access granted. Welcome. Audio file encryption processing. Transmission decoded. Begin playback for system file. Spirit Blade Underground, episode 371.
Hello and welcome to the Monitor Room at the Spirit Blade Underground podcast, a biblical examination and celebration of geekery and geek entertainment, as well as the official podcast of Christian Geek Central, a website and community you can check out at christiangeekcentral.com. I'm Peter Franson from Spirit Blade Productions, producing entertainment and resources to hopefully equip, encourage, and inspire Christian geeks like you, like me, to live more and more for Christ. For more info and free goodies, check out spiritblade.com. On the show today, reviews of the Ant-Man movie and The Amazing Spider-Man Renew Your Vows comic book, and my reactions to some of the reveals at Comic-Con this year. All right, let's get to it. Okay. All right, this is audio journal number 5 since the incident. I'm still pretty sure I've developed some kind of superpowers despite the negative results in the last 4 tests. I'm going to give it another try today after a trip to the hardware store. This is invulnerability test number 1. Healing factor. This is healing factor test number 1. All right, so I just saw Ant-Man this morning. So the synopsis here is that there was once an old Ant-Man who was out of the public eye, who was operating maybe somewhere in the 60s through the 80s, somewhere in there, and he retired to keep the shrinking tech that he invented that allows people and objects to be shrunk down to, like, ant size. He retired and took his technology with him to keep that tech from being appropriated by the military and put into mass production and incorporated into wars and things like that. His company is now led by a bad guy who wants to do that now. And so Hank Pym needs a thief to steal the tech that he created and keep it from being militarized. So that then you enter Scott Lang, who's a burglar on parole with a daughter that he wants to be a father to, wants to be in her life, and he wants to clean up his life, but Hank Pym wants to recruit him, and that complicates things. And so, of course, then adventure and comedy ensue after that, etc., etc. So let me talk about the story, the script, that kind of thing. The plot itself is not really engaging. It doesn't really have major twists and turns. The villain isn't fully formed or very complex. He's a very forgettable villain to me. The suit that he wears eventually is cool, and so, like, what he can do, you know, during the back third of the movie, you know, is cool, but the character himself is, you know, they kind of gave lip service, you know, in their efforts to kind of make him complex and relatable in any way. And he wasn't relatable, but the villains don't necessarily need to be. But at the same time, he wasn't this, you know, grandstanding, like, really extreme type of villain that you don't need to relate to, but you enjoy them just because of how extreme they are. He really wasn't either of those things. But the movie was a neat combination of superhero and heist movie. And I'm trying to think, I don't think we've seen that before. So that was cool to see, you know, because the Ant-Man technology is all about shrinking down and being able to infiltrate places and get through security measures and stuff like that. And so this was a neat combo of, like, several heists and also superheroics, you know, throughout the movie. So I enjoyed seeing that different kind of mashup of story types. There are some family subplot elements that I think help to ground some portions of the movie emotionally, but your mileage, I think, is going to vary depending on your stage of life. There were certainly some elements in there that were about, you know, Scott's relationship and with his daughter and how much he loves her and wants to be involved in her life and stuff that if I would have watched before having kids, I would have, like, followed along, and it wouldn't have been, like, groan-worthy or anything like that, but it wouldn't have had the... It wouldn't have triggered the emotions that were triggered in me as I watched it this time. So, I mean, if you're not in the stage of life where you're a parent, there's going to be some stuff that they put in this movie that really just aren't going to probably mean much to you. I don't know. I think it's just really going to depend on kind of like what your relationship is like with your family and what stage of life you're in as well. Because there's also some father-daughter, you know, with Hank Pym and his daughter, Holly. There's some conflict there and, you know, so, yeah, so I think the whole family stuff, I appreciated them putting it in there. And for me, it had an effect at some good moments that helped kind of ground the thing for me. But I think it's going to be very different depending on, you know, your life experience. The tone is the same kind of action slash comedy tone that we've been seeing ever since Thor: The Dark World, you know, where they're trying to, I feel like, keep that, you know, get that lightning back in the bottle that that we had with the first Iron Man movie, which even the subsequent Iron Man movies didn't quite recapture, even though I definitely laughed in both the second and especially the third one. They never quite recaptured just the magic of that crazy humor comedy combo that was in the first Iron Man movie. But I would say that if you laughed at the jokes in, say, Thor: The Dark World and thought those were funny, then there's a good chance that you'll be laughing at these jokes too. Maybe even a better chance, because I think Paul Rudd is just more suited to comedy than many of the actors that are cast in a lot of these Marvel movies, which maybe are a little bit more suited to drama or action, but they just don't have a real sense of delivering comedy in the same way that someone like Paul Rudd does, who has made his career in comedy, you know. And I would say Robert Downey Jr., who also has done did a lot of comedy before doing Iron Man. But a lot of these other actors, they just don't have the background that these two actors do in comedy. But I should mention, you know, that my sense of humor, it takes an unusual kind of thing to make me laugh. I guess maybe I'm just jaded and bitter. I don't know. You can diagnose me however you want. But I usually don't laugh at these Marvel movies. I never laugh at them. In fact, very rarely do I laugh at them outside of the Iron Man flicks. But I will say that in my theater, although it wasn't a packed theater, there was very little, you know, laughter throughout this entire movie. In fact, the only laughter that really stood out to me was toward the end, and it was the laughter of children in the theater. So I don't know what that says. What I will say is that there are elements in the climax, which is, you know, goes on for about, you know, 15, 20 minutes or so, that feel almost like a kid's movie. And you've seen in the trailers probably some of those elements that I'm talking about, where they're dealing with these little microscopic people that are battling on top of Thomas the Tank Engine as he's going around the track, you know. So there were some gags related to children's toys and stuff like that that I felt really appealed to children, and in fact they really seemed to be appealing to the children in the theater, who were just laughing hysterically at some of those parts involving Thomas. But they were kind of like the only ones laughing in the theater, you know, so I don't know. Like I said, we'll get on to the cast now. Paul Rudd is great as an everyman in a crazy situation, but the material didn't bring his best to surface, though. I think that he definitely got the chuckles out of me that the movie had to offer for my tastes, but it wasn't like, you know, man, just all the laughs per minute ratio is insane, you know. Michael Douglas was appropriately cast, you know, as this kind of like, you know, elder statesman, superhero kind of serious guy, but he wasn't very interesting. I would like to see... I don't know. I won't say anything more about that. But I didn't find him very, very interesting as a character. Evangeline Lilly, who you might recognize from Lost and a few other roles as she's been kind of making her way more into films, it plays Hank Pym's daughter, Hope. And she was fine, but I think the character could have been more complexly written than it was. And that was disappointing. And as I already said, I felt like the villain was just not... You know, underwritten, is that the phrase? I'm not sure. Anyway, stunts and visuals, let's talk about that. Okay, so plenty of CG ants that look like CG ants. They look good. You know, the texture quality keeps getting better and better, but for me, whenever I see something biological moving that's not a machine that's made of CG, it just stands out to me. But I mean, you know... It's how often do we really look at ants super duper close up? So it's like, you know, we don't have in our common experience a lot to compare it to. So I think it's a little bit easier it was for me to suspend disbelief and just go along. Okay, this is what ants look like when they're really big or when you're really up close to them. There was some shockingly great de-aging effects that were put on Michael Douglas in the opening scene, which takes place in 1989. And I mean, if I wasn't looking at like... you know, like comparison shots to like Michael Douglas in 1989, someone could probably tell me that this was filmed in 1989. I mean, and as someone who is cursed with an eye to pick out CG, I was really impressed with what they did to his face. And I think that just, I appreciate them doing something like that, which is not as ambitious as creating an entirely CG character. Because Hollywood, for my eye, isn't quite there yet. They got really close with Terminator Genesis, but they're not quite there yet to make a convincingly, you know, CG person. But they may have now come really close to mastering the art of de-aging somebody, which, gosh, who knows what that'll do for movies in the future. Actors that are able to go back and, you know, reprise roles that they've done in the past and look exactly like they did before, or at least convincingly enough. I mean, yeah, it was really impressive. So much so that I was, like, missing plot elements that were being introduced. I was like, what am I looking at? This is amazing, you know? So that was cool. The shrunken environments look and move like CG. But again, because I don't often look at things really up close, I was able to adapt for the most part and just kind of accept these environments as what I would see if I really stuck my nose into something and took a really close look. So the overall, the action, there was lots of cool action and stunts and CG and stuff. It was unremarkable to me, but it met the current quality standards. It wasn't pushing any boundaries. I don't feel like these Marvel movies do, but it was there. It was solid. You know, there was, as far as like, are there any like philosophical, moral, spiritual issues that kind of popped out at me that might, you know, trigger some worthwhile thought or a conversation? Not really. There was a couple if I was really picking away. At one point, Hank Pym says to Scott, "I think every person deserves another shot at redemption." And his suggestion there is that Scott can, through his actions, redeem himself. And this is true in really every religious system that I can possibly think of, except for Christianity, because Jesus redeems us. It's not because we're able to redeem ourselves and kind of make up for the bad things we've done. We just can't. So it's just kind of like a reaffirmation of that very common idea that we can redeem ourselves. And maybe we can in the eyes of other people, but in the eyes of the one who matters most, we can't. Let's see, what else? There's also, I would say, the idea presented, or let me put it this way, it's the Mrs. Doubtfire effect took hold of this movie. And what I mean by that is, Mrs. Doubtfire was the first movie that I saw, maybe the first movie that ever did this, where reconciliation between divorced people was not upheld as the ideal. That, like, we said, okay, we're going to just settle for the fact that we're divorced and still pretend that we can have just as good of and as functional of a family as we could were we to have a married version of the same thing, you know? Now, you know, I'm not saying that in all cases, like, a married life is always going to be better, more comfortable, and less harmful to a child than a divorced life. But I think, all things being equal, it is far better to have a child raised in a married home, and it is far better for a couple to stay married than to be divorced. And again, I don't want to get into all that. I know I'm sure there are some exceptions coming to mind. I'm saying, all things being equal, I don't think we want to let go of that ideal. And there wasn't any, you know, kind of hint that they were going to try and reconcile at the end of this movie. She had another guy that was a fiance that caused some conflict and drama, you know, which for the plot was, I guess, interesting, you know. But anyway, those two things, you know, this self-redemption and then lowering the bar in terms of our ideal of what a family is, those are so common in so many movies that they didn't really stand out to me. Again, I really kind of had to think, well, what in this movie would potentially, you know, and that's the most I could find. Maybe there's something after you see the movie that sticks out to you. I'd love to hear about that. In summary, if I were a time travel going back in time and talking to myself, I would say, Peter, wait and buy this movie when it's used and cheap, because it's one that you would want to maybe sit down and watch with your boys. Now, they're going to be bored at some parts of it, and you're going to be bored at some parts of it, but it's kind of like in this middle ground where both of you will be able to sit through it and get something out of it. I know that's not really high praise for a movie, but that's where I'm at with this one. Marvel, I think, has mastered the art of not making bad movies. You know, I remember a time when, like, most superhero movies were bad, or, like, it was 50-50. I mean, it just seemed like nobody knew how to not make a bad superhero movie. And then Marvel came along, and they really started consistently, with different characters, making these really solid superhero movies, you know? But very few of them, especially after, you know, maybe the first few that were really great, you know, you can pick and choose which ones you think those are. Very few are, like, truly great movies, you know? A lot of them, they're just, like, not bad. They're good, solid movies, but they are not... they haven't figured out how to make great movies. Now, Marvel's made some great movies, but I say they haven't figured it out because the movies that they make that are truly great seem to happen almost by accident, and then all the wrong things are given credit for their success and then overdone in the movies that follow. And, of course, the humor certainly comes to mind, but I think there are other elements as well, and just kind of, like, the style and general in which, in the way these movies are told, they're not told in, like, they all kind of look the same in the way kind of like they're shot to my eye. There's not really any kind of creative, like, different camera work or you know, different types of storytelling that are really going on in these movies. They all kind of feel the same. And so at the end of the movie, you know, at the end of the day, I kind of look at Ant-Man and say, yep, well, here's another Marvel movie. So if you've been liking these Marvel movies and you're not sick of them yet, go watch this one. You'll probably enjoy it. But I mean, the scary thing there is, if you're a big superhero fan and want to see superhero movies continue, is if they don't innovate, if they don't start allowing more diversity in their creative direction of these movies, people are eventually going to, I think, burn out. And they will confusedly think to themselves, oh, I'm tired of superhero movies. When in fact, they're just tired of this kind of superhero movie. And so I'm afraid that superhero movies will eventually fall out of favor with the public, and they'll stop being made for a long time because people will burn out and attribute it to the wrong things. So I understand that this movie started with a different director who departed due to creative differences, departed, was fired, not sure of the story there, but I can't help but wonder if these movies would be better if they would allow their directors to diversify tone and try new things, offering a slightly more unique lens through which to view this universe with each movie as it comes out. Now, I loved Man of Steel, but I don't want Suicide Squad to feel like Man of Steel. You know, they should be able to kind of coexist. It's a fine line to walk, and I don't have the answers on how they should pull this off, you know, or how they can pull this off. But I think it's what they need to figure out in order for these movies to really last in the long run. They got to figure out how to, in these different universes, Marvel and DC, both need to figure out how to make great, creative, unique decisions in each of these movies, and at the same time have some kind of common ground that will hold them together. Currently, I think Marvel is requiring, it looks like they're requiring their directors to have too much in common with previous films, and I would like to see them diversify their tone and their storytelling a little bit. This one's rated PG-13 for sci-fi, action, and violence. I want to remind you guys to check out the other members of the Christian Geek Central Network, such as the Strangers and Aliens podcast, the Theology Gaming podcast, the Untold podcast, and POSTOS. All these guys doing very different, very excellent work. For more information about the CGC Network, visit ChristianGeekCentral.com.
Hello, Spirit Bladers. This is David Arrington of the Helix Reviews podcast, bringing you a review of a comic book. I just read The Amazing Spider-Man Renew Your Vows #1, and I like, man, I really want to talk about this. And so I think this is the perfect opportunity to talk about something non-Doctor Who related on the Spirit Blade Underground podcast. At this point, I've only read issue #1. You know, if issue #2 is out by now, if issue #3 is out by now, I'm not sure how fast these things are going to be coming out, if they're going to be coming out once a month, or if they're going to be coming out, you know, on a weekly basis, or what this is going to be. This is like a 4 to 5 issue miniseries. I'm not exactly sure, but it's basically it's a Spider-Man story tied into the Secret Wars event. And so let me talk about that a bit. The Secret Wars event is a big Marvel event that's happening right now that's spanning all the universes in Marvel, and, you know, nothing will come out the same and all that jazz. And I've been reading it and thus far had a little bit of mixed reactions. Some things I liked, some things I didn't like. If you want to hear what I think of the entire series, I'll probably end up talking about it on my podcast, the Helix Reviews podcast, when that series finishes. But as for The Amazing Spider-Man Renew Your Vows number 1, this is a miniseries that takes place in Battle World, which is the world that Secret Wars, the new Secret Wars, is happening in. But for the most part, this doesn't really feel like it has to go along with this. This feels very standalone, like it's just an alternate universe, and none of the Battle World stuff that you're reading in Secret Wars really matters. And so, at least thus far, if you're not reading Secret Wars, it still feels like you can read this and just understand it as an Elseworlds story of, you know, what happens if MJ and Peter's relationship didn't get, muted or put out or whatever by the whole, you know, demon getting rid of her relationship to save Aunt May, which I'm not even going to talk about that because that is pretty ridiculous. And, well, I'm not even going to talk about that. But yeah, basically, The Amazing Spider-Man Renew Your Vows is about what if Peter and MJ did not get separated? What if they were still married today and they had a baby girl? So yeah, it's basically kind of a what-if story, an Elseworlds story, thus far not really tying into Secret Wars too much, which in my mind is a good thing for this story because I am loving this story thus far, what they're doing in this story. It's not what you would have thought of with Spider-Man. It's not what he would do in a lot of cases, what you would think he would do necessarily, but in the world of this character, in this Spider-Man's world, that actually really makes sense what they're doing here. It's very different. It's very controversial as far as a Spider-Man story goes, but I am really loving this story. It is a lot of ways very big in scope. There's a lot of characters that show up in this. There's a lot of things happening. Some superheroes are starting to disappear, and we're like, okay, man, what's happening with this? And you start, you know, you kind of figure out what's happening with that. And it's very big, but it also, it really focuses down on Spider-Man and his relationship with MJ and his daughter. And it's very well done, and it's very engaging and really emotionally effective. It really just works on every level for me. I'm just loving this issue, and I'm really hoping that it continues with these big changes and crazy things, because they can actually do this now, because the universe of the Marvel Universe is kind of ending and restarting, kind of all DC style, it seems like. But if we can just get a great, crazy Spider-Man story that you would never see in just an ongoing Spider-Man comic book, because they just couldn't do some of this stuff that they are doing in this series, then I will definitely be happy, because this is not something that you see done in comic books very well, very often. And this is written by Dan Slott, the guy who's been writing The Amazing Spider-Man and The Superior Spider-Man for quite some time now. And I have been absolutely loving his run. He does some really good stuff, and he is really great at doing Spider-Man events, and that's kind of what this feels like. It's a little bit different, and it is a little bit more personal, I guess, in some ways, because in Spider-Man events, you know, you got Spider-Verse, where there's these tons of characters, tons of Spider-Men, and you got Spider-Island, where there's all these different Spider-Men, again, I guess, swinging around. But again, this one just focuses in on this new relationship. It's a relationship that's been there in the comics before, but hasn't been there for a long time now. And there's a decision that Peter Parker makes at the end of this issue that, if you read the regular Spider-Man series, this might not seem like a very Peter Parker-y decision, at least as of where he was at in the 616 universe. But with the universe that they present to us now, with this battle world, with what all has happened to him and him having this family, he makes this decision at the end that might not seem very Peter Parker-y per se, but in my eyes, it makes perfect sense, and it seems like it actually is a very natural extension of what he would be and what he would do. I think it actually makes a lot of sense to me that the Peter Parker that I'm reading in the current Amazing Spider-Man run, you know, or I guess not the current one because it's paused for Secret Wars or whatever, but seeing that Spider-Man do what he's doing here actually makes a lot of sense to me, and I really am enjoying this series, and I'm excited to see where it goes because they can do some crazy stuff that they couldn't normally do, and so I'm very excited to see them do that. And while I'm talking about the creators, I should mention the art is done by Adam Kubert, John Dell, and Justin Ponsor. And the art's all around good. It's nothing exceptional, I don't think. It's nothing you look at and go, oh my goodness, this is absolutely amazing. But it's all around good. It's good Spider-Man artwork. It's solid. And, you know, it may not be exceptional, but it's not bad by any means. So yeah, all around a great comic, and one I would strongly suggest reading, especially if you're reading Secret Wars. This one you might as well automatically read it, but you know, it doesn't seem like it ties into it a lot, at least yet. Or if you're just a big Spider-Man fan, this is definitely one to check out, especially if you're a big Dan Slott Spider-Man fan, because still, this is very much a Dan Slott Spider-Man story. All right, I think that's about all I'm going to say about The Amazing Spider-Man Renew Your Vows, number one. Sorry if my voice sounds a bit off today, guys. I'm getting over a cold, but I had that recording itch, and I wanted to talk about this issue of this series. And so something needs to be done about that, right, guys? When this series finishes up, I think I'll probably send in another segment here for the podcast for you guys so you can get my complete thoughts about it. I'm not going to guarantee anything, but that's my plan currently. So if that turns out, I'll see you then, guys.
All right. Well, while I did not attend Comic-Con this year, and probably never will, it's not really, I'd rather like go to a convention where I can like play games or something. You know, and I don't know, I'd rather just read interviews with these creators and stuff, and I don't need to be there to meet them. But anyway, but you know, like many of you, I took in the lots of the coverage that was available online. So what I want to do now is just kind of go over the blips that were on my radar as I took in the various bits of coverage and reveals and news items that came out of Comic-Con. I'll just start by actually kind of walking through two trailers that caught my attention. One, of course, was the Batman vs. Superman Dawn of Justice trailer, and then also the Suicide Squad trailer. So I'm going to, just so I can kind of like gather my thoughts, I'm going to be playing these trailers in the background. If I listen to the audio when I'm done and this doesn't work, then I'll probably just cut the audio portions out because the a lot of these are going to be kind of like visual context required. So I'll just go through here, and I didn't feel like making a video of these this time because I'm going to review these movies when they come out and then I'll get my full thoughts. I usually don't talk about trailers and stuff, but anyway, here we go.
Today is a day for truth.
Okay, I'll just stop right there. So we got Holly Hunter, great actress. Right away from the very beginning, this trailer starts really soft and emotional. You know, her voice breaks on the word truth, you know. And so that says to me, okay, great. We're going to continue with this very serious kind of tone that the DC movies are going for. And I just like more serious superhero movies anyway to begin with. It just takes an odd sense of humor to really make me laugh, and so most of the Marvel humor has just been falling flat for me. The lightning in a bottle with that first Iron Man movie, and they've never quite recaptured that. In fact, it's gone considerably downhill as far as appealing to my humor since that first Iron Man movie, and outside of the Iron Man movies in general. But I appreciate DC, you know, going with this. You know, every once in a while there'll be a little joke, but mostly just a list. It's a smile or at best like a little chuckle or something, you know, and they're not really going for comedy, you know. But I think there is room for it. And I think we saw even a little bit of that. I'd have to work to bring up a specific memory, but I think you're more likely to laugh, like in, say, Man of Steel, you're more likely to laugh at a move at a kind of like an outrageous moment. It's like, I can't believe they just said that to him, you know, so you're laughing at that. It's not really a punchline that you're laughing at. It's something about the story that just kind of strikes you as funny or unusual or something like that. And so I think there is humor in these movies, even though, you know, they might be saying, you know, we're really not going to do any jokes and stuff. I think there are jokes in them. Well, like Lois Lane, you know, she definitely had like this salty, crass sense of humor, you know, and so there are jokes in these movies. They're just not going for jokes a lot. You know, it's a great balance for my tastes. And so what we've got here is what I assumed, what many assumed was going to happen in this movie. It's going to be about the fallout of the destruction of who knows how much of Metropolis in Man of Steel. So we've got this Senate hearing where a senator is calling for truth and for Superman or whoever is responsible to take responsibility. Great shot of Superman flying down.
The world needs to know what happened.
And there's, if you freeze and see all the picket signs, there of course are the usual, like, God hates whatever. God always hates something, I guess, according to people with picket signs, or, you know, the type of quote-unquote Christians who go out with picket signs and stuff. I say that because I honestly don't know. Sometimes I wonder, are they really believers? You know, believers are certainly capable of some horrible things, but I mean, wow, where do they get that? Where do they get that in the Bible, you know? Anyway, I think it is a representation of the kinds of crazy things you're going to see from picket signs, you know, at crazy, you know, kind of events and things like that that happen. It brings out the crazies. But I think that we saw even in the first trailer, you know, this idea of Superman being, you know, labeled as a false god and we should not worship him. So apparently some people are maybe looking at him as a god or some kind of like a spiritual creature of some kind. They're definitely, it looks like, maintaining that kind of attitude from the first movie, where there was lots of like a messianic kind of symbolism and stuff going on, and they're continuing that and bringing spiritual overtones, maybe even specifically Christian, but certainly spiritual or mythological kind of overtones to Superman.
And to know what he stands for, that kind of power is very dangerous.
Okay, so this is great. I mean, it's like, this is almost kind of like an echo of Watchmen in some ways. Just a touch. I mean, you watch Watchmen to get the Watchmen experience, you know. But there's this fear of, you know, what would really happen. And I think Zack Snyder, having done Watchmen, is equipped to bring us a DC universe with some of that, not to the extent of Watchmen, but with some of that kind of flavors. How would people really react to this kind of stuff happening? And then we've got this flashback, which apparently we is showing us that Bruce Wayne was in Metropolis on the day that Superman was fighting Zod and was witnessing this horrible destruction that was on a level like and from a source that was previously unimaginable, you know, to this Batman, to Bruce Wayne, who maybe has been retired. It looks like that from future things in the trailer, but here we see him running and seeing this horrible destruction. He's on the cell phone trying to do something. He must feel so just impotent as this building is falling down. And this is a really beautiful moment, actually, where we see it's obviously echoing 9/11. But we see this kind of like this firefighter kind of moment where there's a huge cloud of dust that's coming away from this collapsing building. Everyone's running away from it, except for Bruce Wayne. He is running right into it, you know, and that's a beautiful moment. And yeah. And then, of course, we see that apparently he was unable to save all the people he wanted to, as he is comforting a small girl who probably lost her parents. And of course, that brings us back to, you know, him remembering what happened to him. I mean, this has become so personal. You know, he's seeing something very similar happen to this child that he was not able to stop it from happening. And so, you know, that's a wonderful way to bring about, you know, to activate his motivation as a character and to bring his central core motivation as Batman into this movie. And I think that's wonderful. You've got to do that with Batman. Batman movies get progressively worse and uninteresting the more they fail to remind us of why Batman is who he is and why he does what he does. You watch these Batman franchises, and most of the time what happens is they give us the origin in the first movie, and then after that, in the sequels, they just kind of forget about it. And I remember one comic book story that set up this idea that every time Bruce Wayne sleeps, he sees the death of his parents, he relives it. And so he wakes up and it is fresh in his mind. And I thought that was such a wonderful concept for that character. And not all writers have picked up on that and continue to use that, but I think it's awesome. And because, you know, otherwise it just eventually you just kind of forget to feel along with him. And that's what's so important to me in any movie that I watch, is to feel feel what the characters are feeling. It has to be driven by who they are as characters. Otherwise, I'm just not going to care myself about what they're going through. I'm not going to want what they want. I'm not going to feel the pain that they feel on any level, you know. I'm just not going to sympathize with, I'm just not going to engage with the movie. And so right away, this looks like they are going to be, you know, really making a character come to the forefront, at least with Bruce Wayne.
Let the record show that this committee holds him responsible.
Okay, so I guess she does hold Superman responsible. Presumably that's, he's the him she's talking about.
Okay. That's how it starts.
Okay, so we've got Bruce Wayne looking at a paper. It says a dozen's killed, and then what looks like some kind of psychotic handwriting, possibly the Joker, it's in red, says, "You let your family die. Wayne Tower devastated," is the headline. Dozen's killed. So who knows what that's about?
The fever.
This is Alfred talking.
The rage that turns good men cruel.
So evidently he's been off the grid. He's not been Batman for a while, and now we see him training and kind of getting ready to put the suit back on, you know. And then we see Alfred with this, you know, voiceover, presumably saying, you know, presumably talking about Bruce, like, watch out. You're a good man, but you could become cruel. This is how it starts, you know. And this is a kind of young, somewhat hip looking Alfred, but I'm open to it. We'll just see what they do. Maybe they're drawing more on his military history that isn't always mentioned in the comic books.
This bat vigilante is like a one-man reign of terror.
Okay, I love those bats flying down from like this, I don't know, from up above or something, but we're bringing this idea, this mythology of Batman as this creature of the night, this force of nature, and I think you've got to play that up in order for him to work standing next to other superheroes.
You don't get to decide what the right thing is. Nobody cares about Clark Kent taking on the Batman.
This means something. It's all some people have. It's all that gives them hope.
Okay, so we've got Lois Lane back. That's good. And then we see this image of this woman on top of a flooded, you know, the roof of a home surrounded in a flooded environment. She's got a big S painted on her, the top of her roof, hoping that Superman will come and rescue. And then she's holding her arms up as if she's seeing an angel or possibly Jesus himself coming down. And then we pan up and we see Superman with light coming behind him, you know, up in the sky. And, Angry Joe made the observation, why is he just floating there? Save her, come on. You know, why is he floating there for the glory shot? But I'll see it in context. I'm sure it'll make more sense in context. But they're definitely playing up this kind of messianic, this kind of savior figure, whether they're treating him as an angel or as like a type of Christ. They're still playing that up. And I think that's a good thing. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I don't think when creators do that with their, particularly we see it in superhero stories, I don't think they are trying to minimize Christ or, maybe they are, I don't know, but I don't take it that way. I don't take it as an insult. I don't take it as like, oh, they're trying to say that Jesus was just a superhero, you know, or that Jesus was just this, or that this person is as great as Jesus, something like that. I don't take it that way. To me, it's just an echo of, you know, of who Jesus is, you know, and as Christians that are members of the body of Christ, we ought to be imitators of Christ. You know, we ought to look for ways that we can see where people are at and be a part of the rescue process for them in whatever situation they find themselves, you know? And so for me, it's just kind of an echo of Christ, a reminder of Christ, a reminder of who he is and what he's done for us. And so I think I'll really enjoy the Christ imagery. Of course, Superman isn't perfect. Of course, he's not this and that, you know? And I don't think that's, I don't think he needs to be in order to, in a positive way, remind us of who Christ is and how Christ, whether writers acknowledge it or not, inspires all these kinds of savior superhero characters. I mean, they are so, in so many ways, an outgrowth of our built-in desire to be rescued, to be saved by someone who is good enough and powerful enough to save us where we're at.
Be their hero, Clark. Be their angel. Be their monument. Be anything they need you to be. Or be none of them. You don't owe this world a thing.
Okay. Now, I'm not the first person to to point this out, but I think a lot of people are going to give her crap for the same reason that people didn't like, some people didn't like how Jonathan Kent was in the first movie, you know, when young Clark was like, well, what was I supposed to do? Just let them all drown and let them all die, you know, and he's conflicting. He says, maybe, you know, he doesn't know. He's not sure, you know. And I think that there's maybe, we'll have to see it in context, something similar going on with Martha Kent here, you know, where she's saying, go and do these things. If that's, you know, if that's what you want to do, be this, be that, or don't be that. You don't owe them anything. You just be the man that you, you know, are going to be or whatever. And I don't know that that's all that great of advice. But I'm guessing that what she's saying here is motivated by the same thing that Pa Kent was when he said, maybe you should let them drown. I don't know, you know, and that is love for their son. Now, I think you could argue that, that it would be the better thing morally for them to say, yes, you should die for others as Christ died for us. And you should give yourself to that. I don't know the parent that would be able to say that. I don't know the parent that would be able to say that. And so, you know, that makes me ask the question, okay, well, where do we draw the line, you know, between like creating an ideal for content consumers to strive for? Because I think that's what superheroes can do wonderfully, is create this ideal for us. But then also represent realism, represent the struggle and stuff like that, you know? So I think you could come down, you know, either way. I guess I would rather have this than the Kents tell their son to go and sacrifice himself, do as Christ did, and just offer up your life as a sacrifice. First of all, I don't think they're going to do that in terms of with the context of imitating Christ. No way are they going to do that. The closest comics ever got to suggesting that Superman might be a Christian was that he was raised Methodist and his parents went to a Methodist church. that's the closest they've come. And the Methodist denomination, a number of strains of it are, as I recall, fairly liberal. I went to, when I was younger, went to a Methodist church, my family, for a couple of years. And I think they were among the more conservative, biblically. So I think there's a lot of kind of like, liberties taken with scripture, in other strands of the Methodist church. I don't know. I could be wrong on that, but anyway, that's the closest they've come to ever suggesting that, that Superman is a Christian. I don't think they're not going to do that in the movie. So what was I saying? I can't even remember now. But I guess I would rather have them have this conflicted, maybe, I don't know, and show to us their love for their son, their immense love for their son, which I don't think we have enough of. We don't have near enough examples of healthy adult-child relationships when period, and especially not adult parents with adult children having healthy relationships. Think about, when was the last time in fiction you saw that? It's really rare. It's really rare. And I think that's one of the wonderful things that Superman has always had going for him, except for when they keep killing off Pa Kent in various parts of the continuity. But I loved his relationship with his parents in the Lois and Clark TV show and in the comics and in the animated series, you know, in the comics until they decided to kill Pa Kent. Stupid, stupid, stupid. Bonehead move, DC, but never mind. That's a rabbit trail I'll get into later. But anyway, I would rather have this conflicted parent that loves their child. She's at least suggesting, you know what, go do that if that's what you want to give yourself to, and I'll support you in that. But at the same time, they have not been kind to my boy, and you don't owe them a thing for the way they've treated you. I get that as a dad. I get that. So I think in some ways we're kind of getting that middle ground, best of both worlds, in the way that the Kents are responding. We're getting parents that love him and that value the good that he wants to do, because Pa Kent was conflicted when he said maybe. I mean, he understood what Clark was getting at, you know? So I think this is probably maybe the best way to, I don't know. I guess I'd have to see the other version and see if they can pull it off in a way that doesn't feel like, what parent would say that?
know. Yeah, sure, son, go and get yourself killed, you know. No, that's an extreme version, but I guess I would just have to see the alternative. Somebody write me that and then cast some actors and show me what that would look like, and then I'll tell you which one I think works better.
You never did.
Do you know the oldest lie in America, Senator? The devils don't come from hell beneath us. They come from the sky.
I'll talk more about Jesse Eisenberg in a minute.
20 years in Gotham, how many good guys are left?
Okay, so we see a costume behind glass with a yellow spray paint that says, ha ha ha, the joke's on you. If you freeze frame it, there is an R on that costume. So it is definitely Robin, who apparently was killed. So we're looking a little bit at, they're borrowing certainly strongly some elements from Frank Miller's The Dark Knight Returns.
I'm going to stay that way. He has the power to wipe out the entire human race.
Okay, so we got Batman suiting up again in the Robo suit. All kinds of speculation on, you know, where that Robo suit comes from and, you know, how it can help him go up against Clark. I'll just wait and see the movie myself, I guess. But he's taken a pretty extreme position. We have to destroy him. I'm not the first to mention this, but I will agree with it, that this movie runs the risk of making Batman seem stupid. You know, and maybe, you know, in as long as if he starts stupid and just totally rage blind, then he needs to at least end the movie and say, you know what, I have made a mistake and I need to get back to using my mind, because he is the world's greatest detective. And so he could find out who Clark is, what makes Clark tick. He could find all that stuff out, you know, I think. And I think he would do that before saying, this guy's got to die, you know? So, and maybe this trailer's being deceitful in some way. I don't know, but they are, obviously are going to fight. So anyway, we'll just kind of see how that plays out. I'm okay with Batman being rage blind, but it's gotta be temporary and it's gotta be fixed, by the end of the movie. I don't know why there's this cowboy movie thrown right in the middle of here. We got horses galloping. I don't know what that is. Such a weird... I guess maybe they're just establishing a story that spans the globe. Or something. Including places in the desert where people are still riding on horses. Okay, again, we got a flashback shot with of Bruce's origin, of his parents getting killed and him witnessing that, you know. Great. I think you need that. You don't have to do the whole thing. You know, we don't need another Batman origin movie, but I think in every Batman movie, there should be some kind of brief little reliving the horror moment that created him. Then we got presumably the Batwing flying down, I think, to go and take on Superman or something. I don't know what he's going to do. Okay. So now we got... I should say that I'm buying Ben Affleck as both Batman and certainly as Bruce Wayne. Jury's still out on Batman, on how he plays Batman, how he does the voice and stuff. That's the thing I'm most concerned about, is even when in the panel at Comic-Con that I watched of him, his voice kind of broke a little bit when he spoke a little bit lower in his range. And I'm like, you can't do that. You can't have your voice break when you try to speak lower as Batman, or your Batman's going to sound like he's going through puberty. So anyway, I'm sure that they would only use the non-voice breaking takes. So I guess I'm not too worried about that, but it's still just hard for me to kind of imagine. So now we've got Gal Gadot, I'm not sure how you say her name. English is not her native language, but in listening to her speak at one of the panels, it's not a super thick accent, so hopefully that won't be a big problem. And she looks cool as Wonder Woman in these shots in the movie that they show in the trailer here. The action shots look cool, okay? They look cool, but I'm not sold on her as Wonder Woman. She I see her arms now. I see her legs now. This woman did not bulk up to represent the kind of Wonder Woman that I want to see. Now, I'm not talking about some gross female bodybuilder, you know, extreme version of Wonder Woman. You know, I want something that's just more muscular than this. She just looks too much like a model to me. And in my mind, I know there's the argument that was presented to me a while back that, you know, like her strength doesn't come from how big her muscles are. It comes from, you know, like whatever, kind of like how Superman's muscles, you know, or his strength comes from the sun or whatever. Well, I get that. You know, she's got these supernatural powers. But I think unlike Superman, she is a warrior. And so she, as a warrior, it makes sense to me she would constantly be training and pushing her body to keep it in the best physical condition it could possibly be in. Even if she's got to bench press freight trains to make that happen, I think she would do it to get her body in its prime, in its like ideal state, so that she would be at her maximum fighting capacity when the time comes that her gifts are needed, you know? And that makes sense to me. It actually makes more sense for her to be bulked up to me than for Superman to be bulked up. I just wanted more. I wanted more bulkiness. I also wanted, I guess, just... I'm not sold on her performance in these brief action shots. She looks like a model who's like kind of going, "All right, now this is my angry face." You know, I don't buy her rage, you know. I want her face, I guess, to be a little bit more contorted, to get a little bit more ugly, you know. And I feel like she's just not committing enough to the anger. I want to see Wonder Woman when she's in combat. I want to see her freaking kind of lose it a little bit. I don't mean mentally so she's not in control of her actions, but I just mean I want to see rage, you know? And this, I just kind of see an actor doing their angry face, you know? And I'm not really into that, so... It looked cool, though. I mean, the good news is we got Zack Snyder filming her, so... You know, the action is going to look cool. It would look cool even if you put me in the Wonder Woman costume to do all those action sequences. Zack Snyder would make it look awesome. But, you know, it would be a little weird to see me in that state, and I don't know that I would be much more convincing than Gal Gadot is to me. All right. So the next shot, we see Batman in the desert, and this is another part that I'm like, I don't know, you know... Batman during daylight, already I got problems with that. And then also he's got like this kind of what looks like a trench coat and other things, you know, on him. Like a brown leather trench coat, like he's a Firefly fan or something. And he's fighting these soldiers. And did he maybe even have like goggles or something on his mask? I don't know. But to me, I'm like, no. Don't do that. Don't bring him in the daylight and don't reduce him to a soldier. Don't give him a soldier vibe, because there's soldiers all over the world. They're great soldiers, you know. Then he's just Captain America in a big, thick rubber costume that he can't move as easily in. You know, no, Batman works best as a mythical creature of the night, as an urban legend. That's how Batman works. That's how he can even intimidate, you know, guys like the Flash, or maybe even Green Lantern. I didn't say make him afraid, but he could intimidate possibly at least Green Lantern or Superman or Wonder Woman, you know, is the things you don't know and can't see about him. And so I'm a little concerned about, you know, that kind of daylight action. Again, we'll just see how it plays out.
He is not common.
Okay, so we see Lex Luthor, played by Jesse Eisenberg, hovering over Kryptonite. So Kryptonite is brought into the story. I don't know, we'll just see how they use it. As long as it's not used, you know, as kind of like a lame crutch in all the movies going forward from here, I think it could be used in a really clever way. I hope that it's Batman that discovers it, because I think that's a way that potentially Batman could outsmart Superman, is to figure out where he came from, do the math, and maybe even create the kryptonite by irradiating it or something. I don't know, but I could see that playing into, you know, how Batman could pull off, you know, a stalemate at least with Superman. But I don't know. We'll see. As long as it's not used cheaply, I'm open to what they could do with Kryptonite.
Black and blue. God versus man. Day versus night. chaps are coming.
So then we have this series of awesome action sequences I won't even try to describe, brought down by Jesse Eisenberg's "The Red Capes Are Coming" line. I don't mind the line. I'm not sure that I'm going to be into this Lex Luthor at all. This Lex Luthor looks like he's going to be annoyingly unlikable. Whereas Lex Luthors of the past, I like him when they're intimidating. I like him when they are... I like him being a threat. I just don't like this. What he looks like is this entitled little kid, little brat. And it's one thing if someone is a snob and like they, I don't know. This is totally, I have no way to argue that this is bad. I have no way to argue that this is a bad move or that it betrays the character or whatever. I don't think I can argue that. It's just, I just don't know that it's going to resonate with me. I want Luther to be threatening, and this guy just looks like he's going to be an annoying thorn in Superman's side. It's like, what is this kid doing? This kid is just meddling and just getting in my way, and he's just doing stupid stuff. He's just meddling, you know? I don't know. I don't know. I just don't want this entitled little rich brat. This looks like a guy who kind of got wealthy by accident. You know what I mean? Like he invented Facebook, like Jesse Eisenberg, played the creator of Facebook in another movie. This kind of guy strikes me as a guy who got rich by accident. He inherited his money, or he did one thing that who could have known it would totally blow up and just be insane. He doesn't look like a guy who is really, really smart. You know, he looks like a guy who's maybe a good social manipulator and a social mover and shaker. But he doesn't look like he's really freaking brilliant. And that's what I want in my Lex Luthor, in addition to all those other things. You know, I'm not saying I want Gene Hackman or Kevin Spacey. Actually, maybe the Luthor that I like the most is the one from the animated series. I don't know. I don't know what I want. But I don't know if it's Jesse Eisenberg. I'll just have to see it. But right now, it's not what I want. Right now, what I've seen, it's not what I want. Okay, so then it ends with Superman ripping the doors off of the Batmobile and Batman standing up to do a face-off with him. So, I think for, like, the most part, this looks like it's going to be fantastic. I do have my fears, but then I had plenty of fears going into Man of Steel, and I went into the theater like, I don't know if I'm going to like this. And 10, 15 minutes into that experience, I forgot all those fears. They melted away, and the movie took me by surprise, and I loved it. And so I'm open to Zack Snyder kind of surprising me again with some of these elements that I think won't work for me. And I'm already excited for the elements that I'm like, these will definitely work for me. All right, so on to Suicide Squad. I'm not going to go near as long with Suicide Squad. And I'm not going to watch the trailer as I talk about it, because there wasn't a ton. It was a teaser by comparison. So it looks like what I would say that's encouraging me the most is that it looks like it's going to maintain a similar kind of color scheme and feel to the look of the Man of Steel and Batman versus Superman movies. And so they're creating this kind of, okay, so this is now this cohesive feel that we're going to have in the DC universe. I would definitely assume that we're going to get more jokes going on in the Suicide Squad movie. I mean, we already see some of those in the trailer. But I'm very much looking forward to this. I loved Gail Simone's run on The Secret Six, which is basically like a redo, a different version of Suicide Squad. It was just fantastic. And so I really like Deadshot as a character. I don't know what Will Smith will be like. He won't be what I envisioned, just based on the kind of the jokes and the, you know, comments that he you know makes in the trailer. But I do think he's going to be they're playing up the family man thing, which Floyd Lawton, I believe that's the name of Deadshot, is a family man, and ultimately he does the Suicide Squad, he does all that he does for his family, because he's got like a daughter at home that he's responsible for. He wants to get out of jail so he can get back to. And I think maybe the gimmick with him is he gets back with her, he gets out, and he just keeps screwing up his life and ending up back in the Suicide Squad or something like that. I don't know what the deal is there, but he's this conflicted man who is a criminal, but he's also a family man, you know? And it looks like they're going to play that up, and I think that's wonderful. And then we've got a bunch of other characters, you know, that are probably going to get killed off one by one. Maybe, hopefully at least half of them will get killed off. I think that Suicide Squad stories really work best when at least one or two squad members die. Boy, that makes me want to watch this one run of Suicide Squad where like almost half or more of the team got killed every single mission. You know, the roster would change every 3 to 6 issues because, you know, the team was getting killed off in horrible ways. It was, it was great. But yet before they died, they really made these characters relatable and cool for their swan song. You know, it was great. It was great stuff. So what else we got going on in this trailer? We got Harley Quinn. I'm not a Harley Quinn fan. I know a ton of people like Harley Quinn. I'm not really sure why. To me, she kind of falls into the Supergirl, Super Dog, Super Horse, Batgirl, Batwoman category, where it's just like, hey, we had one great idea, and now we're going to do the female version, the dog version, the horse version. Just like, guys, can we just keep, you know, innovating and getting deeper into the original concept instead of branching off? And so I don't really get what the appeal of Harley Quinn is, but she's in this movie, and I think we're going to witness her creation. I'm guessing that we see the Joker, of course, played by Jared Leto. I'm not sure how to pronounce his name. Let me get on Harley Quinn first. Let me finish up there. I'm open, but I don't know I don't know why she's on a team like this or what her purpose is. I don't know. I mean, this was an observation that Angry Joe, which is a YouTuber that I watch now and then, that he made. Like, everybody else on the team has these special abilities and stuff like that, you know. But what does she bring other than being a psycho? You know, so I'm not sure why her involvement. I'll have to watch the animated Suicide Squad movie again, because I think she was in that one, but I don't remember why she was on that team either. Anyway, maybe she's a combat expert. Somehow getting tortured by the Joker turned her into a combat expert. I have no idea. But speaking of which, we do see Jared, I'm going to say Leto for now, in his first appearance on screen as the Joker in this trailer. And we're probably witnessing his torture of Harleen Quinzel, which turns her into Harlequin when she snaps. We see very little of Jared Leto's Joker in this. But what I'm seeing so far, I'm impressed with. Now, we don't see a lot of his tattoos, which is kind of a little bit of a sore point with me. I'm not sure how that's going to play. Maybe in the way that they film him, they'll be de-emphasized, and they'll just be kind of like these little markings. You can't quite make out what they say and stuff. But when they showed that close-up shot where you could see what they said, I was like, this is too busy. This is too much. But maybe, you know, the way they use the camera on him, it won't be too much. I'm open to it. And I'm a lot more open to his crazy silver teeth when I saw this than I was when I saw the still. I was like, oh my gosh, this is working for me. It seems like they took some inspiration from Marilyn Manson. Now, I could be wrong, but it looks like they're drawing from Marilyn Manson in the way that they're creating his makeup a little bit. His performance, it has a little bit of what Heath Ledger did, I think. It's just a slightly, slightly bright voice. You know, he brightens up his voice a little bit, you know, makes his vowels a little bit wider. So he kind of carries that over from what Heath Ledger was doing. But he definitely has his own thing that he's doing, and I think he's a little bit more animated and expressive than just a touch more than Heath Ledger was, and that's what I wanted. Heath Ledger, his performance grew on me. It was quirky and weird, but it had to, and you know, it grew on me. But the Joker I like is just, he's kind of a grandstander, and he's a performer while he's doing his thing. You know, whether he's chopping somebody up or slamming a cream pie in their face, he is a performer, you know, and loves the attention. I already got, you know, that sense a little bit from this performance. I mean, he walks into the room shirtless with his arms spread, like saying, look at me. And I'm like, bingo, that's who Joker is in my mind. That's what I want to see. And then the voice and what he was doing and, you know, his line, it wasn't a terribly funny line in terms of how it was written. You know, he says, I'm not going to kill you. I'm going to hurt you really, really bad. But the way he says it, you know, and what he's doing in this very subtle way was, it totally got a laugh out of me, you know, and at the same time creeped me out. I'm like, thank you. That is what I want. So just take that ball and you run with that through the whole movie. Okay. I don't want that to be just one good moment like the pencil gag was, and then we didn't see the Joker that I really wanted to see for most of the rest of that movie. There should have been pencil gags all over Dark Knight Returns. Or The Dark Knight, sorry. Was that the name of the movie? Batman Begins, The Dark Knight. Yeah, okay. So anyway, there's that. What else do I have to talk about? I'm not going to talk about Suicide Squad anymore. It looks like it's going to be my kind of movie for the most part. I saw a trailer for Minority Report, which just looks like it's a sequel to the movie, and it just looks so much like a TV show, and just like it looks like it's going to be so conventionally told and uninteresting. You know, I really wanted to. I was like, "Well, they're making a series. Well, I don't know, I'm going to watch this trailer." It looked like Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., but without the humor, which is a step in the right direction for me. But, you know, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., as cool as the visual effects and stuff like that is, it's still just a TV show that's shot in a very TV show kind of way as compared to, say, like Breaking Bad or The Walking Dead or Battlestar Galactica or certainly Farscape, you know, where it's shot and the story is told in just a much more compelling and creative way. And I just don't think we're going to be seeing that in Minority Report. And I just don't have time for TV shows that are not freaking amazing. And this one looks like it might be good, but I don't have time for good. So hopefully you do and you'll enjoy what they do with that. Let's see here. What else we got? Oh, the GL, Green Lantern Corps movie was announced. It's the same as the Green Lantern movie. The date hasn't changed. They've just specified that it's going to be a Green Lantern Corps movie. That sounds good. Step in the right direction, you know. I'll look forward to that. I've always felt like that works. That concept will work its best in the movie sphere if they bring in that kind of military/police aspect of the Green Lantern Corps and really play that up and make it about the Corps. All right, and now let me close up by just talking about some DC comics announcements. You know, the announcements and the panels that DC had this year were mostly media other than comics. That's what I saw. That's the coverage that I saw. Now when I looked at their schedule, yeah, they actually did have that. That's not fair of me to say. I think they did, maybe it was like half and half or something like that of panels that were talking about comics and what they were going to do with the comics. There was just a ton, maybe even it was half or maybe even more, DC panels were related to, you know, movies, TV, stuff like that. So what does that say? I mean, to me, that says that, you know, these concepts, these characters are working better in mediums other than comics right now. And I mean, that's what I've kind of been seeing from my taste for a while. We got Justice League Gods and Men that's going to be coming out. And that's basically a storyline that's going to involve the Justice League getting the powers of the new gods. You know, it's like, OK, so this is a temporary gimmick. We're going to have Batman floating around in the Mobius chair and doing all kinds of like infinite godlike things and whatever. OK, well, you know, that doesn't say to me, ooh, a stunning new direction. No, it's a storyline that eventually is going to end and then we're going to turn, all these characters are going to return to the status quo. So that does nothing to give me a sense of what this DC universe is and what it's going to be going forward. And then we've got a bunch of Convergence spinoffs, and Convergence was a big event which kind of temporarily resurrected the old continuity, the pre-New 52 continuity. I didn't read it. And then put it away again after everything was done. But they're going to have like two or three new ongoing series that are based on characters that came out of Convergence. And one is Lois and Clark and Son. It's about the pre-52 continuity Superman and Lois and their son, their like toddler-aged son, and them living their lives now or whatever. And it's not what I wanted. It's not what I wanted, you know. I didn't really want, you know, I really don't want to see a story where Superman is, I don't know. I don't know that I want to see Superman ever really become a dad. I'm thinking that probably works better as kind of like this idea that he would love to have one day, but is kind of denied him because of other responsibilities or something, you know? So I don't know. We'll see how that plays out. Then we got more Earth One one shots. There was a graphic or a trade paperback miniseries, whatever you want to call it, a while back, that was kind of like just like a what if this was Superman's origin. It was just kind of like a clean slate reimagining of the Superman origin. And it was really well received, but that universe hasn't been expanded. Well, they're expanding it now by doing a Flash Earth One miniseries and an Aquaman miniseries, or maybe they're one-shots, I'm not sure. But they're these limited, you know, stories. They're going to be told and then be done. Which makes me wonder, okay, that's interesting. Still, that doesn't do anything to correct or woo me back to the New 52 version of the DC Universe. I have a thought on what's going on with DC right now, but I'll see if you notice this pattern as I continue. The next announcement I saw is Multiversity 2, where Grant Morrison, did some awesome Justice League stuff early on and then just went off the deep end with crazy postmodernism and all of his stuff and didn't make any sense. And for some reason, they keep having him write comics. I guess, well, we live in postmodern time. Maybe that just says something about our time and what people are hungry for. They're hungry for postmodern stories that don't make any sense. I don't know. No, I'm being too hard on him. These multiversity stories are about like alternate Earth stories. So again, more stuff about the not core DC universe. So we've got Justice League Gods and Men. That's a temporary gimmick. It's going to just like, it's a diversion from the status quo. We've got Convergence spinoffs, Lois and Clark. Again, that's separate from the main status quo of the DC universe. Then we got more Earth One one shots. Okay. That's an alternate universe. Now we've got Multiversity 2, TOO, which is going to be another series of stories that are about alternate DC universe places. The next big announcement is that the Milestone universe is returning with Earth M. They're introducing Earth M, so all the Milestone characters, again, another alternate continuity. And then we're going to get two Superman miniseries, which are just going to be like standalone. They're doing their own thing. So it's, again, not about the main core DC universe and what's happening there. And then there's a bunch of new Vertigo titles that have been announced, and that's separate. It's either a totally different continuity or it's like a fairly removed corner of the DC universe. And then we've got Frank Miller coming back to do Dark Knight 3. These are the announcements that I saw. I was looking for like what's, because I wanted to know what's going to happen in the main DC universe. What are their aspirations for these characters going forward? And I didn't see any of that. I just saw a bunch of gimmicks going on. So we got Dark Knight 3. That's about future old timer Batman. And then Superman in the current core DC Comics universe currently has his identity revealed. So Clark, everybody knows he's Clark Kent now. And DC in one of their promotions says this is a change. The glasses are off for good, they say. And then he also has reduced powers. So he's riding around on a motorcycle beating up bad guys with his bloodied fists or whatever. I mean, it's, oh, man, what? What? This is insane. This is insane. Now, hopefully, what's going on here is that these are all stalling tactics as the guys, the minds in DC figure out how to make the core universe better over the course of the next 5 years with hopefully maybe a new continuity reset. I hope they're just stalling until they feel like it's been long enough to reset the continuity and do a true ground-up reset this time instead of just like, yeah, we're resetting it. I mean, there's some of the history still intact, and that's going to be kind of confusing, but we're also going to change some stuff and make everybody angry, and we're going to kill everybody over 40. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, and Amanda Waller, you know, Amanda Waller's like thin and sexy now instead of like this big, imposing, you know, overweight but very large and in charge, you know, black woman. You know, now we got this sexy thin lady, and you know, good gravy. It feels like they're saying, we got to do what the kiddies want. Let's kill all the grown-ups. We don't need any grown-ups talking to us. We don't need any of the classic golden age characters. They haven't learned anything that's worth passing on to us. They're just stupid old people. Kill them all. Make them young and gay or whatever we're gonna do, you know. Oh my gosh. So I'm hoping what this reminds me of is the 90s all over again, when they were doing these really extreme gimmicky stories. It started with killing Superman, then we're going to break Batman's back, then we're going to make Green Lantern go psycho, you know, all these like event stories. And, you know, the event stories, they lasted for a while. They lasted for like, you know, in some cases, I'm trying to remember, like, I think Superman, it took him like a year to come back from the dead, from the time he was killed to the time he really truly came back. And Batman, for his back to get healed, maybe as much as a year. I can't remember. 6 months or a year or something. It was a while. And, you know, it's like, okay, well, you know, at the time, it had never been done before, those kind of extreme events. And since then, we've had little events happen since then, like when Superman turned into blue energy Superman and stuff, you know. And that was the, I think that was the 90s too, you know. And what it feels like DC is doing now is just a bunch of kind of like event stuff, but prolonged over a much longer period of time. They're just stretching it out, you know. Like, let's totally disrupt the core of who these characters are. But let's keep it that way for a really super duper long time. It's such a shame. You know, what I want from the DC characters is much more closely represented in other media. If you look at, you know, where DC has diverted from the core of who these characters all are, you look at the TV shows and they are staying much more true to who these characters have been for a much longer period of time. And so I'm hoping that I'll be able to just kind of wait this out while DC gets all these things out of their system. Because, you know, fans of that don't read comics, that are, you know, just, you know, looking at these movies and these TV shows, eventually they might get drawn to the comics. But what's going to happen is they're going to, you know, I'm hoping, is they'll be like, what? This isn't the Superman I wanted to read. What are they doing? You know, what is going on with the Flash right now? Or what the crap with Green Lantern or Batman or whoever, you know? I want the guy that was in that awesome movie. I want the dude that was in that awesome TV show, you know? So I'm hoping that I can just kind of wait this out a while DC gets all these things out of their system, and hopefully fans will eventually join me in having a taste for some of the more iconic and enduring elements these characters are known for. In the meantime, I'll just keep watching the movies and a few of the TV shows, maybe, and play some DC video games, and then read some old comic books that I don't have to give any more money to enjoy. So I'm rooting for you, DC, but it doesn't look good. All right, well, that's it for me and my thoughts on Comic-Con. I'm not a Marvel guy, really, so if anybody, like, wants to chime in and send me their thoughts on, like, Marvel announcements or other announcements, I'd love to kind of get reactions from you guys and what you thought. I'd be happy to share those on the show whenever you send them to me. Okay, this show's going way long. But if you want to send me feedback, just a reminder, P-A-E-T-E-R at spiritblade.net. Also, mark your calendars for July 31st, Friday, July 31st, 4:30 to 10:30 p.m. Pacific time. I'm going to be doing a Summer of Free video game live stream for 6 hours of my favorite free and retro video games. This will be much more commentary heavy than, say, the Agape Geek Out live stream that I did, where that was really just more for me to play and enjoy games. And I'm going to enjoy myself playing these games, but I'll definitely be engaged more and talking more about why I like these games, and maybe sharing a little bit of trivia that you didn't know or that you did know, and you can tell me, Pater, you're an idiot. Everybody knows that already. But anyway, Friday, July 31st, 4:30 to 10:30 p.m. At ChristianGeekCentral.com. Let's see here. Oh, also, if you are looking for something that you're used to finding in a certain place online related to Spirit Blade Productions, it's probably because I'm kind of in a transitionary time right now. So, like, if you can't find the homepage for the podcast or for a blog or something like that, go over to SpiritBlade.com. And if it's not there yet, it probably will be soon. And of course, if you want to email me with any questions about kind of where you can find what you're looking for or whatever, you can email me at P-A-E-T-E-R at spiritblade.com. I still want your summer free suggestions. Keep those coming my way. My YouTube video review of Ant-Man should be up by the time that you hear this, so if you want to share that with somebody, I'd really appreciate that. And of course, I want your voice and your interest to be a part of this podcast and Christian Geek Central. For more info, email me, P-A-E-T-E-R at spiritblade.net. Stay tuned for Farscape Shawarma after the credits, or jump back to episode 310 to start from the beginning next week, if God God wants it to happen. I'll be sharing an interview with the guys at the Saving the Game podcast and a review of the sci-fi comedy Pixels. Till then, check out SpiritBlade.com and Christian Geek Central for more stuff made just for you. Thanks so much for making time for this show, especially for this super duper long, overly long show. But I hope you enjoyed it. I was really excited to bring all this content to you this week. And I hope you have a great week and that you'll join me. Oh, you know what? I almost forgot. I want to thank David Arrington for sending in the review of the Spider-Man comic. Thank you very much, David. Now I'm off my script. Oh, yeah. Have a great week, and I hope you join me next time here on the Spirit Blade Underground podcast as we continue to geek out and seek the truth.
The Spirit Blade Underground is a community-supported endeavor of Spirit Blade Productions. This podcast is produced by Peter Frampson with support from the Christian Geek Central community at ChristianGeekCentral.com. For information about the latest entertainment and resources from Spirit Blade Productions, visit SpiritBlade.com. Thank you for listening.
Prepare for immediate starburst.
Okay, so that was The Choice. Was that 316, 317? I can't remember now. Anyway, it's follows Revenging Angel, which is the episode that follows the death of Crichton. So now we're back with the Talon crew, the crew that suffered the loss of Crichton. And they're on a planet where that is full of, like, mystics and people who kind of, like, are mediums and that kind of thing. And Aaron went there initially to try and get in touch with John. And then while she was there, even this is, I don't know how many times I've seen this episode, it's still never super clear to me why she kind of changes her focus to seeking out her dead father. But anyway, maybe she was just kind of like thinking about the people in her life that have died, you know, that were valuable to her or significant to her, you know, in some way, and, you know, wanted to get closure on that. I don't know. It's the episode still feels like the whole, like, bringing back Zalek soon, her mother, and the masquerade of, you know, that she tried to put on to, you know, so that she would get the chance to kill, you know, make Aaron think that she was watching her father get killed by her mother before her eyes, you know. That was the plan, and, you know, because Zalek lost so much because of, you know, what she suffered from the Peacekeepers because of her relationship with Talon, Aaron's father, and the birth of Aaron, you know. So she wants to basically take that out on Aaron and see Aaron suffer. and so, I don't know. I've always felt like bringing back Zalek soon at this point, like, her death was better. Because she dies at the end of this episode again anyway. And I felt like her death in where we didn't see it, where Kray supposedly shot her, you know, as Aaron and John were walking away in that other episode earlier in this season, I always felt like that was stronger, you know. And so that kind of, you know, part of this, I don't know if you call that the main plot or the subplot, or I don't know how you categorize these things, but but the, you know, certainly this episode was still very largely about Aaron dealing with the death of Crichton. I mean, I would say that's most of what I think of when I think of this episode is her mourning the loss of Crichton. And what I usually forget is all these kinds of, like, mental flashbacks or hallucinations that she's having. I forget how much John is in this episode. He's in it a lot, you know. And despite his death, the last time we were with this crew, we are seeing even further the connection that Aaron and John had. And we're seeing it through Aaron's eyes, which I think is even more valuable, you know, to see it through her mind, you know, what John meant to her, who John was to her, you know, and just the intimacy they had, you know, with each other and the familiarity. That's what I mean by intimacy. Yeah, so it's still a really strong episode. It's just very dark. It's a downer. know, and it's not even like, it doesn't bring me really to the point of tears. Maybe I think I welled up more at the previously on Farscape when they showed her crawling into bed with the dead Crichton and kind of like putting the covers over them so that she could be with him just a little while longer, just after he died. My tears welled up more at that than any part of this episode. This was just kind of a dark, grim episode, you know, with no like real emotional climax for me, you know. Did you notice Alice Cooper, the guy with the bleeding eyes? It's not really Alice Cooper, but every time I see that guy, I'm like, dude, that totally looks like Alice Cooper. I'm wondering if I might have even heard that in, like, a commentary, that, like, they even made a joke that, like, there's Alice Cooper. So I can't remember, but he's always looked like Alice Cooper to me. It's really funny. Anyway, yeah, so it's... I'm trying to think of what else I might have to say about this episode. We've got the exit of... Well, I'll finish talking about Erin first. You know, of course, now by the end of this episode, she's kind of hardened herself. She's realized, okay, I can't get John back. I just have to live without John. And so she braids her, you know, her hair again into that single long peacekeeper ponytail. And she's back into full-on peacekeeper mode, you know. And that's, you know, you see in some... you know, TV series, these characters that will have kind of like their status quo reset to kind of what they were before. And it can feel kind of cheap, you know, like it can be like, okay, they have this relationship and then there's the relationship gets bumpy. And so it gets reset, you know, and that usually doesn't work for me. That usually feels cheap to me because usually whatever triggered that is just kind of a shallow thing that I'm like, you guys are both adults. You ought to be able to work through this. The relationship that has developed up to this point should not be freaking reset just because you have bad communication skills in your relationship. I mean, it's just stupid and it feels shallow. But this, I feel like they earn a reset on Erin's character here for her to go back to like cold peacekeeper mode. Because she's dealing, because he died, you know. I mean, that is not like some bump in the relationship, you know. And so it works for me here. And so, you know, going forward, now, of course, the big question is, well, what the heck is she going to be thinking about this, the John on Moya when she gets back there, you know? I mean, she's acting as though John is dead, which really tells you she just made a choice, probably soon after the two crews separated. She just made a choice, like, this is the Crichton that I see as the real Crichton, or something along those lines, you know. Or she just chose to not think about the... who knows? Who knows? We really don't. And so that's kind of a big question that will be interesting to see, you know, how that plays out as we go forward from here. Of course, I know how it plays out, but hopefully, you know, this is some... that's a question maybe you're wondering as, if this is your first time. Then we've got also Stark leaving at the end of this episode. He's got a tendency to kind of come and go in this show. And I believe that's because he had a very active, the actor had a very active stage career. I believe in his exit now was because he was cast as the Phantom of the Opera in a major production in Sydney. And so he was going to be doing that for, you know, like a year or half a year. I can't remember how long it was, but he's going to be gone for a while. And you know, and so Stark in this series just has this habit of like going away and then like suddenly being back in the crew. And, you know, they tend to give very little explanation for his comings and goings, which is weird, which I think is because they just kind of have to work around his schedule. You know, it's not really plot and story motivated his comings and goings, you know. But I don't mind his absence. I'm not a huge Stark fan, you know. But anyway. So there we go. That was the choice. And next time, I think we're getting back into... I think it's the reunion of the two crews, if I'm not mistaken, in Fractures.